Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Hopeless Romantic Podcast. I am Austin Chan.
I'm Amanda Jean.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Jordan L. Hawk. Jordan is the award-winning author of the Wyburn and Griffin series, the Spectre series, the Hexbreaker series, and more.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Of course, we are absolutely thrilled.
Jordan writes a lot of wonderful specfic, especially, but one of the reasons that we particularly wanted to have Jordan on is that most or all of your work, Jordan, that is self-published?
All of it self-published. I do have a couple of French publishers to do translations, because that's something that's just way too much work for self-publishing for me at this point, but otherwise everything's self-published.
So Jordan is a very successful self-published author, and we really wanted to have her on to talk about how people can get started in self-publishing, what the ups and downs are, so on and so forth. So we can hop right into self-publishing. We have many questions, and I thought we could start with why and when did you start self-publishing?
Well, a little bit of background is that I actually did 10 years in traditional publishing under a different pen name, and my first book came out way back in, like, 2001. So I've seen enormous changes in the publishing landscape. I mean, self-publishing wasn't really even on the horizon as a viable career choice back then. And I did a little bit of everything in traditional publishing. I did writing, but I also did some slush pile reading. I did some cover art. I did a whole bunch of stuff, basically everything other than editing. That was one thing I was never really interested in doing. So I really had kind of a background in the field already when I decided that I was going to start over, take advantage of the new changes in technology that I felt a lot of traditional publishers weren't taking advantage of, and give it a go on my own.
What were some of those advantages that you were interested in hopping on?
Well, all kinds of things. I mean, one of the most obvious ones would be doing sales. I mean, it sounds crazy. I know publishers do sales. But for example, one of the things that I had a lot of success in, particularly in the early days, would be to discount the first book in a series to 99 cents when the next book comes out. And that seems really obvious, and it's easy for someone like me to do it because I only have to worry about my own catalog. For a publisher, they have these options, but you know, when you have 100 authors, it's really a lot harder to do that sort of thing, to have that kind of flexibility. And these were things I really thought, this is just one example of that sort of flexibility that traditional publishers, especially at the time, just weren't taking advantage of. You know, another thing simply is that it's your name on the cover, and if something is wrong, whether or not it's your fault, you're going to be the one blamed for it. You know, and also, you know, if something goes right, you're going to get the praise for it, even if it was something totally out of your control, like a beautiful cover or whatever. That was another reason. I'm kind of what I would like to call a control enthusiast. So if something was wrong, I would like to try to fix it if possible. And again, it's my name on there. So self-publishing gave me an opportunity to do that and to, you know, go back and fix things or to get things the way I wanted them to be, as well as taking advantage of different technologies, of being able to do audiobooks, of being able to be on different platforms. I had a publisher I worked with a whole bunch of different publishers of various sizes, but like the medium, one of the medium sized ones, they were really bad about putting their backlist up on Amazon. So I would have like part of a series would be on Amazon, like the first few books that were sort of pre-Amazon, back when FictionWise was the big ebook publisher or ebook vendor, you know, were never up there. And it's like, well, can't you get that up there? Well, yes, but, you know, we have 500 authors and, you know, you're just one of them.
Yeah. And that really limits discoverability, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And it also, I mean, when you have a backlist that's accessible, like even if it's not selling a lot of business, you still get accumulated royalties. A couple copies when you have a pretty decent backlist is at least something. If there's nothing up there at all, you're not even making enough for a steak dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. What they call the long tail of marketing, as long as it's up there, it's going to sell something, even if you're not really doing anything to promote that particular book. It's always going to be bringing some kind of money in.
So one thing you said that I thought was an interesting point in there was you own all of those sort of steps in the process. You might not be, you know, you might contract out for a cover or something with someone, but you own that process of getting the cover. And I think for people who are considering self-publishing, that's something to take into consideration, is you're gonna own every step in publishing, and that's not just writing a book. Whereas if you're submitting to a traditional publisher, you kind of can, you still should be, you know, a marketer, and you still should care about those steps in the process, but you're not the cover artist. You're not the editor. You're not necessarily the marketer.
A lot of the reason people turn to self-publishing is just for a bigger chunk of the royalties, because they feel like, well, if I'm going to put all of this effort into something and the publisher, let's say even the most well-meaning publisher who is professional in every single aspect of what they do, they're still taking a pretty significant portion of their royalties. And so if you're sort of doomed to a publisher that isn't as top-notch, sometimes you're rolling the die, seeing how great is their marketing, how great is their cover art, what is their editorial process like? And at least if you're self-publishing, you have control over all of that, for good or for ill.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being able to hire and fire people is huge. You know, getting an editor who is good for you, who can help actually improve your book and not just, you know, proofread it, for example. Yeah, you know, having a cover that reflects it and, you know, doesn't whitewash it, for example, or whatever. You know, you have the power in that, and you don't have to kind of be stuck with, well, here's what our art department came up with. Sorry, it totally doesn't fit the, you know, I mean, hopefully they know what they're doing and it fits the genre at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I've, you know, I'm sure we've all seen, bought books, heck, from the Big Five, where we picked up and like started reading it, like, this is nothing like what I expected, right?
Yeah. And in queer romance specifically, you get a lot of generic stock photos of handsome young men or young women on the cover. And it's like, sometimes they don't even match the descriptions of the characters, which is my favorite. Like, I pick something up. Oh, these look like two handsome generic young men. And then I start reading. I'm like, no, that's not what they look like. I've been betrayed.
Totally not. I mean, everything is a trade-off. You're self-publishing and maybe you have a cover that you liked, but it's just not selling, or it's not selling as well as you think it could, then you can go back and have it redone. That's actually one of my big projects for this year. Is I'm hiring a couple of cover artists who are going to go back and, you know, redo a bunch of my books covers. And it's something I can do, which, you know, a traditional publisher is not going to have the time or money, just because they have so many other authors, unless you're a breakout star.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, let's refresh your covers every so often. That's not going to happen.
Whereas when you are your own publisher, you're your own priority one at all times.
Yeah, if you have the money and the impetus, you can change your cover every month. I mean, that would be a nightmare, yeah. But you could do it if you were that sort of like megalomaniacal author.
It's a little overboard, but you could in theory do it if you wanted to.
Yeah.
No one could stop you.
No one could stop you.
So what is at least your process for self-publishing a book, kind of like from start to finish?
Oh, wow. Well, I think it might be more useful to know how I did it at first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, basically, like I said, I was coming out of traditional publishing, so I knew some of the basics, but I actually took a year between making the decision and starting to work on Hainted, and when I actually published Hainted, just to find out all the stuff that I needed to and to get everything organized. So one of the first things I did was going out and reading a bunch of books and finding information on both business and self-publishing. There's a lot of really bad advice out there, and trying to kind of sort through that and looking at, you know, my advice to anyone just starting out is, look at who is giving you this advice. Is their career a career you want in the future? So if this person has a bunch of books out and they're doing very well, then their advice is probably going to be good. If they're just giving you sort of short-term tactic, scammy kind of stuff, or if you're like, I've never heard of this person, like, who are they? And it's not just because they're a different genre, then do you want to be taking their advice? So that was a big part of it right there, was sorting through, figuring out what do I need. Once I finished the book, one of my first steps then was to find an editor, which I really advise people to talk to other authors in your genre. So I'd heard my editor's name put about by a couple of other authors who I knew were self-publishing and doing pretty well at it, at least one of whom was writing romance. And so I was like, hey, what's her name? Can you introduce us? And that's how I found her. But there's lots of other ways to find an editor. But finding the best editor you can afford at the time is, I think, huge. You know, looking at covers, figuring out what kind of cover art you want, hiring a cover artist, which I did not do. I was doing my own covers, but do as I say, not as I do kind of thing in this case, because a lot of authors have no background in design or art, and you can get some really bad covers that way. So
I think we've all seen
we have all seen them. We have. So I definitely suggest, you know, get your editor and get your cover artist. Those are the two big things to start with. And then I also took the time to build up a backlist because no one had ever heard of Jordan L. Hawk. I was coming completely starting over again from nothing. So I took that year to write Hainid, to write Widdershins, to write Hunter of Demons, and with the idea that I would have books coming out like so often in the next year to kind of build up my presence online so people would know who I was. So instead of just, oh, I finished a book, I'm instantly going to throw it out there as fast as I can. No, think about your career in the long term. It's not just about this month.
I realize not everyone wants to talk about budget, but I feel like newbie authors who are coming into the industry and thinking about self-publishing maybe don't realize that the amount of money you have to have set aside to at least afford two editing passes is not nothing. If you start with some shorter material, you might actually be able to afford it. But having a novel edited by a freelancer is not cheap. And if it is cheap, there might be something wrong. A lot of freelance editors are facing trying to get work, especially if they're just starting out, trying to get work and trying to price their stuff so that they can live, but also so that other freelance authors can afford to pay them. You're probably going to want to at least pay for a content and line editor. You might be able to get by with having someone you trust proofread you, but it's just a tricky situation to rely on free labor for something that people are expecting. I mean, even though self-publishing has its reputation as being both good and bad, they're expecting it to be to a certain quality if they're going to spend money on it. And I think the best thing for self-publishing authors or potentially self-publishing authors is to look at it as an investment, as a business, as a startup, because it's not something that you can throw. Let's say you're writing a short story, you're going to publish it, you're going to probably put it up on Amazon. You're still going to want someone to look at that. You're still going to want to make sure that it's not riddled with errors, because you can sell copies of something, but it's not going to move. It's not going to move if it's not to a certain standard. And that includes formatting, that includes the cover art, that includes the blurb, that includes every single aspect of your project.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the weird things that strikes me about self-publishing is that, I mean, if you're in the restaurant business, no one is going to say, I'm going to open a restaurant and not expect to not have upfront costs, right? Like, no one's going to be like, I'm going to open a French restaurant. Oh, but I don't, you know, I'm not going to pay for a space to rent or ingredients, or, you know, whatever. Part of the problem is people don't realize that writing is an art, but publishing is a business. And that just like any other business, you are going to have upfront costs. And again, if you're, like you said, if you're expecting to make any money back on it, you have to pay those upfront costs. So I would definitely suggest people set aside a budget of it, you know, at least if they can afford it at all, you know, of at least a couple thousand dollars just to get started, because, you know, that could be lowballing. It just depends on how fancy you want to get. You are going to have to, you know, get hire editor. I definitely, a lot of people skip development / content editors, but I've read so many books where I was like, something, the pacing of this book is off or whatever, and where it's technically flawless, but I don't finish the book because it really, a good content editor could have gone through and been like, yeah, you know, you have three pages of, you know, this person riding the bus and literally nothing happens, you know, at all, except they're riding the bus and you're describing them riding the bus and they don't meet anybody and nothing happens. You know what I'm saying? Putting that out, and for Hainted, the editing fee that was my birthday present and my anniversary present that year. We were like, yep, you know, instead of doing something, you know, getting a present, we're going to just set that money aside and, you know, pay for it. Good cover artists can run anywhere, you know, from a couple of $100 up.
Yeah.
You know, easily to like $500 or $600, depending if you want print formatting stuff too. Formatting, for sure, for ebooks, if you don't know how to do it yourself, and there are a lot of good guides out there. And so I was originally doing all of my formatting myself, which that was the first thing I hired out because it's just tedious. So tedious. Oh my God. Yeah. So if you are good at that kind of minute following instructions and getting this and getting that and checking and blah, blah, then go for it. You know, that is something you can do yourself. But dear Lord, you know, if you can't or you just don't want to, you can get some basic edit, basic formatting, you know, nothing fancy, but basic formatting for relatively inexpensive and have it work. So do not skip that if you have any problems formatting, because that's going to screw up your reader's experience and they're not going to finish your book and they're not going to buy the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I actually, something else that I upgraded this year, Hexbreaker, was first I had formatted by a different formatting company, E.M. Tippett's, I believe, because I'd seen one of their books done for J.A. Huss, who's a het romance author. And I was like, wow, this book is beautiful. It's so pretty. And it just adds to the experience. So I was like, well, I'm at the point where I can hire somebody to like make this beautiful formatting, you know, for me. And also use my other formatter for like ARCs and Smashwords and stuff. So
it almost feels like you're leveling up. Like at every stage in your career, you're able to outsource one more element that you would have had to have done yourself and maybe taught yourself how to do. Because that's the thing about self-publishing is like you have to be a jack of all trades, but by necessity, sometimes elements of that will suffer because it's not your period of expertise. It's not your period of expertise. It's not your point of expertise. But yeah, it's a funny thing to take on all of that responsibility yourself, and you know, read FAQs and read guides and reach out and find out as much as you can. But just by virtue of the fact that not all of us have a background in publishing and not all of us can pay for outsourcing formatting or can pay for the more top-end cover art, it's just sometimes you kind of have to prioritize and be like, what can I spend the most money on and what can I do myself?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, knowing what to prioritize is a big thing. I mean, your cover and your editing are probably the two big things.
Mm-hmm.
You can muddle through with formatting and have it be perfectly readable. It may not be beautiful. The person may not open it up and go like, oh my God, this is a gorgeous book, you know, but that's fine. That won't sink you. Whereas the other two, you know,
they definitely
will definitely have way more of an effect on your sales.
Yeah,
you know, for sure. That's why I tell people, you know, is what you can afford at the time and to, like, to set the money aside to give yourself a good start. You know, you're doing your, even if it takes a year, giving yourself a good start is going to make a huge difference down the line because, you know, you're just ahead to begin with. And then, again, like you said, optimizing. Later on, you can go, oh, you know, I'm at the point now where I can go back and get all of my books reformatted into this, you know, very pretty, beautiful thing with the flourishes and the fancy fonts inside and all of this stuff. You can have a beautifully formatted print book, but you have to get to that point in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like for authors who are considering self-publishing, it might be helpful to, you know, especially an ebook, because it's likely that you'll be working with ebooks, and try to break it apart. Because I think a lot of people just look at, you know, copy editing. In general, what people point to when they're like, oh, this book wasn't well produced, it's like there are typos in it. Really, it's so much more than that. If you read an ebook that's beautiful, that happened, like you're saying, because the author either is an ace at that themselves or outsourced it. A beautiful cover that catches your eye, developmental editing that tightened the story up and made the pacing work. And oftentimes people only recognize those things when they're done wrong.
Yeah,
but exactly.
Like, I think we've all opened up like a really ugly ebook in our lives and been like,
yes,
this was just, you know, run through like a program and a human never actually set eyes on this to verify that it was readable.
Yeah, this was a Word document that got shunted through an automatic formatter. like Jordan said, if you can make it clean and readable and functional, it's not going to ding you. But if you're going to take a shortcut and slap it through some sort of basically EPUB, Mobi, whatever generator, it's not going to look good. And people are going to open it and they're going to be like, oh, this is an amateur work. It's your first impression aside from your cover. They're going to open it up and they're going to look at the rest of the content with suspicion, because they're like, if they can't even, there's wonky breaks and there's, you know, heading errors and stuff like that, they're not going to want to trust you.
Yeah, I've seen books where clearly the Word document they used had, you know, a running header, you know, title and page, and that got put into the ebook. So you're reading along and you're in the middle of a paragraph and suddenly there's this great book by author B in the middle of the paragraph. And that happens like every, you know, five paragraphs or something. And it's like, no, you know, they didn't even look through it. That's going to give a bad impression. I am not going to buy another book from that person just because it makes it hard for me to read when I'm being interrupted by the title and their name every five paragraphs.
Basic accessibility.
Yeah, I'm reading a book right now that was from a previous, like a non-digital catalog that got just converted. I mean, it's even from a publisher, but there are no scene breaks because somehow those all got deleted in the conversion. And it's unbearable.
You just sort of have to guess.
It's a really good book, but I just have to guess when a scene switch has happened based on
context. Oh, Lord.
Context.
I once read a book from one of the big YA publishers, and I cannot remember which one. And it was a very well-known YA author, and they had clearly just taken the print book and scanned it somehow, because every lowercase L had rendered as a numeral one.
Oh no.
Every one of them, the whole freaking book.
Oh god, that's painful.
What the hell?
Oh man, that's the thing, is like, you kind of wonder with the switch from print-based to the digital heavy market we're in right now, how many, you know, medium-sized publishers just weren't prepared to make that switch? Did they make an intern do the formatting? Did they hire someone? Did they go take a class? What happened, you know, in this awkward adolescent stage of trying to switch over to a completely different medium? At least a lot of the LGBT presses coming up now are coming up with the understanding that they're digital first. Their main audience is going to be digital, and print is sometimes not even an option, especially if they're working with limited means. So at least they understand that they have to make it look pretty. They have to at least try, because you can't just upload a Word document and drop down and be like, save as PDF. There we go, I'm done. And then like convert the PDF to a Mobi file and convert that to an EPUB.
It's fine. What could go wrong?
Nothing can happen if I do this.
Technology always works perfectly. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm done. I don't ever have to look at it again. Let's put it up for pre-order. Oh no.
Jordan, you've worked with print as well, right? With self-published print books?
Yeah, I have. And speaking to people who are interested in self-publishing in your audience, at least for this genre, it's definitely what they call a 20% activity. If you don't know what I'm talking about, like the 80-20, where, you know, 80% of your stuff comes from like 20, you know, the results. So you can do all this stuff, it only results in like 20% of your sales, or, you know, this small amount will present. So, I mean, like 2% of my sales are like print. I would not necessarily be like, that's something you need to do out the gate, unless there are reasons to do it. You know, just liking to have that, doing sales at cons, that's the big reason I do it. Having that higher print price on the same page as your Kindle will make your Kindle version look slightly less expensive. You know what I'm saying? So they'll say print price, you know, $11.99 with a strike through for it. Ebook only $4.99. That was something that someone else mentioned, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess that is true. It never occurred to me. That's something, again, where you can really make it ugly. And I've seen from publishing houses, not the big five or anything, but LGBT publishing houses, I've seen some really ugly print books.
Same.
Haven't we all?
Yeah, it's not just a matter of taking the ebook and like converting it to a PDF and uploading it to CreateSpace or e-commerce. Yeah. There's a definite art to that. So again, there are like a lot of places that will, you know, blogs and stuff you could look on that will show you how to do it. And that's another one where, you know, doing the formatting, I've done all of those myself, but that's because it doesn't take me very long anymore to do on print, because I've gotten it down to a science pretty much. But yeah, I definitely hire somebody to format it if you don't. And if you don't have the money to do it, that's definitely one I feel like you can skip in the genre and not be heavily penalized for.
Because I feel like it's when it's done well, it's really cool. It's almost like if you have an established fan base, that's like a collector's edition. Yeah, it's got that appeal. But if it's done poorly, it's not really going to help you.
And it just looks bad. I mean, you don't want to... Again, it's your name on the cover. You don't want it to look bad. You want it to look as nice as you can make it.
Absolutely. And so I know you also have audiobooks of some of your self-published stuff. So did you contract out to get those made?
Yeah, what I've been doing is going through ACX.
Yeah, ACX.
Audibles, yeah. They're self-publishing. That's ACX.com for anyone listening who doesn't know what I'm talking about. But you can basically set up an account, and there's voice actors, narrators, all kinds of people on there who are looking for work. And if you know someone already because you listen to a lot of audiobooks who you want to work on your book, you can obviously contact them directly either through that service or privately on your own and talk to them. But you can also just put up an audition. They allow you to list your book, say, hey, you know, here's a scene, usually like 5 to 10 minutes, and anyone interested in it is going to like read through the scene, do their interpretation of it, and send it back to you, and you pick between those, or if none of them work for you, you take it down for a while and then put it back up. So that's one of the things that, again, I wouldn't necessarily recommend for someone who's just starting out, because it is not cheap to do, not if you want it done relatively well, and it is time consuming. You have to listen through to the whole thing, so you know, just like going through a proof of a print book after I formatted it. You know, I want to go through, have it printed, look through, and make sure there's nothing wrong with it, right? No formatting errors or weird stuff's cropped up. Same thing with audiobook. You have to listen to it. Okay, this line was weird. Maybe I made a mistake and there was a typo and they read the wrong word out. it is time consuming. It costs money, but I really believe audio is the future. So that was one of the reasons I really wanted to get into it as soon as I could afford to. Yeah, it's just getting bigger with every year, and with more people having phones and switching back and forth. You know, I don't know how many people are like, oh yeah, you know, I've listened to your series 5 times. Wow, that's, you know, pretty time investment. People do it while they're doing other things, and that's, you know, huge. And I think that's really coming up. So it's like I said, it's something you're just going to start out. I would wait until you have built up enough money to pay for it, for sure, but it will be something critical in the future, I think. So, I mean, right now, print's about 2% of my sales. Last year, audiobooks were 13% of my sales, and that was up quite a bit from the year before. So it's something that's definitely growing that people, I really think, need to be aware of.
And it's such a neat accessibility thing as well. And I feel like ACX is really cool as well, because you, as the author, you can really tailor that to a potentially really unique voice. And one that, again, yes, like, is exactly tailored to your story, whereas a generic, much like with a generic dude on the cover, it might not represent your story very well.
On ACX, you have the option to, if they audition and you like them, you can tell them, like, I want, because you get to select categories, like, if you want them to read it sensually, if you want them to be British, you can choose what general tone you want, but you can also tell them, I want you to do this faster, I want you to do this slower, your pace is a little bit off, so you can definitely customize to a degree what the audio experience will be.
Yeah, and I definitely, for anyone who's thinking about doing this, pick a scene from your book that will showcase their talent, especially if you're casting for a specific character. So like with Wyborn Griffin, I mean, it's all from Wyborn's point of view in the first 5 books. Obviously, that's who I was casting for, so it didn't really make as much of a difference. But for Spectre, I was casting for Gray, because if you don't believe what's going on with that character, if they don't get his tones right and his expressions right, if you don't believe his emotional journey, the whole book falls apart. So, you know, I made sure that I had a scene that had multiple people in it, including him.
And you want to know that the voice actor is able to effectively do different character voices without it turning into a farce or, you know, being confusing, because you're not always going to have, you know, not every scene has 80 million dialogue tags. So if you have an exchange of dialogue and they're not good at pacing themselves and they don't really differentiate their voice, their voices, it can be confusing. And I've had that happen. I've listened to audiobooks from Big Five publishers where just by virtue of the fact that the book isn't huge with dialogue tags or there's a lot of dialogue, it can be difficult, especially if there's scenes with multiple characters, because you can only make up so many voices without yeah. it turning into a really strange like sideshow experience.
My narrator for Whiteborn Griffin, Julian, was laughed at me one time because he was like, damn it, you know, you wrote this scene that has like five different characters and they're all talking back and forth to each other and having to switch back and forth. They were all distinct voices, but you know, I was definitely, when I was writing this, I was not like, this is going to be really difficult to do for a narrator someday. And now I kind of think of that in the back of my head when I'm writing, actually. I'm like, oh yeah, some narrator's going to have trouble with this. I got five people talking at once. Good luck, future narrator.
Yeah, I started to do that a little bit because last year was the first time I'd ever read one of my books out loud, and I all of a sudden realized how hard it was, you know, without the visual cue of a paragraph divide and a new quotation mark to tell who was speaking. And so now that's something that's often in the back of my mind, is like, a couple more saids wouldn't hurt
here. A little action tag here, maybe, or something.
Yeah.
My favorite thing, too, is, like, people who actually just use said when it is most appropriate. I know that this is a little bit of a tangent, but I'm so happy when it's a dialogue tag that is just said and isn't exclaimed, ejaculated, shrieked. Oh, make my day. Simple dialogue tags.
I mean, sometimes they do shriek, but of course. Very rarely.
And I mean, it's
very rarely.
I feel like if the way you've structured your dialogue and the way that you've maybe put an action tag or some sort of narrative description in, you can convey tone and you can convey panic and you can convey whatever you need to without saying, he said in a panicked tone. Which, I mean, there's a time and place for that, too. Sometimes you don't want to spend two paragraphs showing. Sometimes you just need to tell. But, oh, I'm so in favor of he said, they said, she said, whenever possible.
I was going to ask, another thing that publishers do a lot of is marketing and outreach to readers. So how do you connect with readers, and what kind of marketing work do you do?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I do about the same amount of, that's the one thing where I feel like there's a lot of, I feel like that's one of the areas where people kind of overestimate what a publisher is doing for you. I mean, not that they aren't marketing, because they are, and definitely one that has a big presence at different shows, for example, you know, always has a table, who's always sponsoring something or is running ads places, that is definitely going to be a benefit, and I don't want to sound otherwise. But honestly, I am doing about the same amount of marketing than I was when I was with traditional publishers. You can take that for what it is. I mean, a lot of things people say, like sending reviews out is the big thing that the publishers do. And while reviews are important, there's a lot of other things you can do that to reach readers directly. I think that tangent with that are a valuable use of your time. So one of the things I've really sort of tried to emphasize is connecting directly with readers as much as possible. So being on Facebook, I just started a new Facebook group called Wittershins Knows Its Own for people who want to, you know, kind of chat with each other, with me, you know, outside of just the regular Facebook time stream. Twitter less so, being accessible, you know, answering emails, having a newsletter, making sure you put the right email address in the return for your newsletter, which is something I just screwed up. So, whoops. So I have not been as accessible as I wanted to. That kind of thing is really super, people underestimate how valuable that is, just being there, just being a person, not a marketing engine where you're book blast, my book's out. I mean, obviously when your book comes out, you want to say, hey, my book's out. But if you've laid the groundwork and like actually shown people you're a human being, then people will be tweeting that for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, you
know, they'll be retweeting that for you because they want to, because they enjoy your book and they want to tell their friend. But, you know, just a lot of that's, and not time consuming, not spending 5 hours a day on Facebook, but you know, 15 minutes in the morning saying, hey, how's it going? Or reblogging this adorable kitten picture, or, you know, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry that mother's in the hospital, I hope everything's okay, or what a cute baby. You know what I'm mm-hmm. saying? Like, and not in a disingenuous fashion, but like, sincere, actually connecting with people. That goes a lot farther than I think people realize. You know, you can blog forever, and I've read a lot of good blogs, but that has not necessarily made me want to check out the author's work unless it was something really directly pertaining to their work, which usually would be nonfiction. Yeah, but there's a lot of people I've talked to casually on Twitter where I'm like, oh, your book's out. I'll download a sample from Amazon and check it out. And then if I really love it, then I will immediately go on and tell everybody that I know, hey, you know, this is awesome. You should read this person's book.
You know, you always want to shill for your friends. And so if you come off as a human being that people want to succeed, I feel like that taps into that same thing where, like, you know, if my best friend has a book coming out, obviously I'm going to be like, whoa, go look for this. This person is great and their work is great. And if you can come off that way as an author, I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, it really does.
Staying away from being a marketing machine, because I've seen authors only use their Twitter or only use their Facebook as self-promotion. And that's what Jordan was saying. Be a person first. And I would say an author and a marketer second. Like, yeah, you want to talk about...
Yeah, distant second.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's always cute. Like, I follow a bunch of authors on various sites, on various social media. And I honestly never like them more than when they're just tweeting about, like, their day and how, you know, it's hard to write or how they're putting off whatever they're doing to watch TV instead, because you feel like you're getting to know a person. When you're reading the book, eventually you're just like, oh, they managed it. I'm so proud of them. They managed to do it. I'm so proud. I'm so pleased. You know, that starts, people start to become familiar with the book before it even has a blurb. Or a title in some cases.
Yeah, I was on Twitter constantly a couple months ago complaining about Griffin. Damn it, Griffin, why won't you cooperate with me? I mean, a lot of people responded to those saying, oh my gosh, be nice to him, or or telling him to, like, shape up, damn it, because they wanted to read the book. Just, yeah, being fun. And honestly, one of the big advantages to marketing while self-publishing is that you have immediate and fine-grained access to how your books are selling. So if you're with a publisher who's sending you, you know, let's say most of them, I believe, pay by the quarter still. You get your royalty statement every quarter, but okay, well, what led to the up or down in sale?
Get a day by day or week by week.
Right. So for the first 2 years, I tracked everything week by week. So I put down, like, what I was selling, where I was selling it, and what I did that week. So my first book tour, and that may have been because nobody knew who I was. I did a book tour, and yeah, I got nothing for that. Now, later on, that might be different. And it may also have been the tour company. I want to hastily add that. But I could say, okay, this did not work. Yeah, for whatever reason within this, it did not work. Running this ad on Goodreads did not seem to, you know, do anything. Doing this blog post over here got me a slight bump, or, you know, a review on this site. Or, like, suddenly I had an unexplained spike. Hated came out in September of 2012 and Wittershins came out in December. And in January, all of a sudden, Wittershins started moving big time. And I was like, what's going on here? I literally haven't done anything. There was nothing to connect it to say, like, oh, I did this blog post or I had a review. And I found out that Reese Ford actually read it and was, like, telling everyone she knew to buy it.
That's awesome.
Was buying copies for review sites. And I did not know her. Like, we did not know each other at all. We had never spoken. So I'm like, well, obviously having the right person talk about your book, which is pure luck, is, like, you know, unfortunately it's pure luck and it's something you can't really control other than writing a good book in the first place, you know, got me more than anything else I've been doing. Yeah, so I try really hard to pay that back. When I read a book that's especially by somebody who isn't well known, I want to, like, tell everyone that, oh my God, you have to read this book. It's amazing. You know, I love it, because that makes a huge difference.
Genuine enthusiasm over something that doesn't seem... Because there's been cases where I've looked at authors who are shilling books, and it doesn't seem to be out of genuine enthusiasm. And also, mm-hmm. I've seen authors who just constantly retweet reviews of other books, or half of their content is promotional, like, clearly got some sort of buddy system in place. And that starts to ring as, you know, it starts to ring as pretty blatant self-promotion and promotion of other authors. So if it's a case where you yourself are saying, like, oh my God, I love this book because X, it's not just a retweet of someone else's tweet. It's not just a link to a blog post. It's your earnest enthusiasm. That's infectious. especially if you already trust the author. KJ Charles recommends a book, I'm probably going to read it. There's a short list of authors that I already trust, and then they sort of shine a flashlight onto other authors. Oh, okay, they seem awesome, and if such and such like them with their taste, I'm going to like them too.
Yeah, if I recommend something, it's because I either read it specifically and love it, or I've read other books by this person and I trust them to deliver a good book, and I'm going to read it as soon as I can.
Yeah.
So I'm really conscious about, I don't just retweet stuff, even from people that I like, because maybe I like them, but I just haven't read their book yet, because like everyone else on Earth, my to-be-read stack, you know, if it was actual physical books, I wouldn't be able to fit it in my house at this point, you know?
Yeah. My Kindle is a depressing landscape.
I try to be really careful for that reason, because if I'm making a recommendation, I want it to be a real recommendation, and that's just part of what we were talking about, the whole social capital, I guess, that of being a genuine person online and not just randomly retweeting stuff and being a marketing machine. To me, that all that is tactics versus strategy. This sounds like really awful when you put it that way, I guess, but there's a lot of short-term tactics that writers grab that will maybe on the short term get you more sales. And they tend to be kind of scammy or at least kind of false. Like, well, all five of us will retweet each other all the time, whether or not we actually like these books or not. And, you know, what is that? That might do a bump, but no one's going to trust your recommendations in the future and maybe won't think much of your books either. You know, versus, okay, in the long term, I'm not going to do that, but I'm going to build like real relationships in the long term, or as many as I can, or earn the reader's trust in the long term, so that whatever new kink gets thrown into the whole publishing thing, you know, Amazon implodes or Amazon destroys everyone else or, you know, whatever, you can weather it because you've put into work to being a long-term writer, a long-term person with long-term relationships.
Yeah, and not trying to rely on those silver bullets to just skip that hard work.
Yeah, it's not a week of promo and then you're good. It's a long game. And it's not even a game. I know that publishing is an industry and being an author is a profession, but at the same time, you want to at least enjoy what you're doing. And if you're just slogging through endless marketing, it's not going to be fun for anyone, least of all your readers.
Yeah, definitely not. I'm pretty sure I never bought a book just because the author tweeted, "Buy my book," 12 times in an hour.
Never in my life. That makes me put it on my internal never read ever list. I was going to ask you, because I know less about review copies and stuff like that for self-publishing. Can self-publishers release stuff on, for example, NetGalley, or is it just a case-by-case basis where you send to review sites and stuff like that?
You can release stuff on NetGalley. There is a pretty substantial fee attached to it. And I actually just heard, I know a couple of authors who did that, self-published authors who did that recently and did not see anything like a return on the money they put, like, you know, they got so many downloads and like two reviews from it or something. So to me, that probably not worth the putting it out there. I've been considering it again, thinking like, well, maybe, and from what I'm hearing, it's not really probably worth the expense. A lot of people also have personal assistants or virtual assistants who send out reviews. Something a lot of people hire out, have a list of reviewers and say, okay, send to all these people. I still do it one at a time just because I like talking to the review sites directly as much as possible, just so that I'm kind of a face, you know, not a face, but, you know, a voice instead of just here, review my book, you know. I still like having those connections. So I have, I don't know, maybe 20 sites. That might be more than I actually send out to.
20 options. I just send,
yeah. And if so, yeah, 20 options. And some of them I have listed, like not all of them or have reviewers who are interested in all series. So I just have, here's a site, here's the series they've been reviewing. You know, obviously, if they ask for something else, I will happily send it to them. Or when I do something new, like with the Hex World series, I basically just send out a blanket email to all of them saying, I'm starting this series. If anyone wants to review it, let me know. Otherwise, that way, you know, they're getting something that their reviewers want to read. And for sites that are very small, you're keeping up that personal connection just by doing it sort of a case at a time. So I could probably get a few hundred reviews if I really went, you know, nuts, but I don't think it would be worth my time and effort, and I'd rather have it aimed at review sites that like the kind of things that I'm doing. If they're not doing, if they only like contemporary, all the reviewers, then, why am I sending them a book? Which is one of the things I think the blanket sort of, we send all of our books out to all these people approach that I understand why publishers take it, because you can't really tailor that kind of thing per book, but it's not always as helpful as it could be. Because, they can send it out to 50 sites because they always send all books out to those 50 sites, but those sites may not be a good match for you.
Yeah.
Jordan, I was just wondering if you have any tips for staying self-motivated.
That was what I was going to ask.
Well, that was never mind then. Like, since you're not contracted with a publisher, you're not beholden to someone who's like, this is your book deadline. How do you stay motivated and still get books out on in a timely manner?
I give myself deadlines. Basically, starting with 2013, I literally laid out the entire year because I have an idea of how long it takes me to do something, to do a full-length book or a novella. And I emailed that list to my editor saying, I will have these books on your desk at this time, on this date. I'm one of those people who I really don't like feeling like I'm causing someone else problems. So like, well, she's got this in her schedule. Then if I miss that date, then I've just messed her schedule up. So I better stay on it. So that really helps me knowing my process, for one thing, and how long it takes me to research, how long it takes me to write, how long it takes me to revise something is a big step towards that. But then, I just lay the year out ahead of time. It may not be like I know exactly what I'm going to write, because I think like for 2012, I think I had like unknown third novel or something written in there at the time that ended up becoming Stormhaven. But just having like, yes, I'm going to write this, and this is when it's due to another person who is not me or not my beta reader. So that keeps me motivated a lot, I'll be honest. But it's also my full-time job. So I have a certain schedule where, I get up in the morning, I check email, and the rest of the morning is either writing or planning or something connected with the direct, production, usually writing next book. So,
yeah. Human accountability.
Human accountability. I'm actually trying to get where I can take weekends and evenings off now, which is like, whoa.
What a luxury.
I was really bad about like just working all the time for a while, and I kind of realized that was crazy and I needed to really kind of focus on my process and get rid of stuff that wasn't helping. So yeah. I have Freedom loaded on my Mac now, so when I'm writing, you can schedule your week ahead of time, so I schedule that, not on a day-to-day basis. I'll sit there Monday and be like, okay, every day, this thing's kicking on at 8:30, and if I was in the middle of an email, too bad, because it's turning on now, and it's not going to turn back off until, 12:30 or whatever,
That honestly sounds ingenious.
I think that would be priceless. Although I would probably end up disabling it.
I should probably do that.
You should do it.
I have right now I have just a very simple free website blocking extension. And my favorite thing about it is that it lists how many times you've tried to go to a particular website and shames you. It's like, wow, you've tried to go to Facebook 10 times. I'm watching you.
And I'm like, oh. Did I even really need to go? I didn't. I was going to say productivity is super important for authors who are starting out because, generally speaking, that's not going to be their full-time job. So they can't spend as much time on it. So I would say that making sure, let's say you're trying to write a novella, budgeting time that you can reasonably set aside that will not cut into the rest of your life. Let's say it's on the weekends and you write 4 hours a night on the weekends. You budget that out and you get rid of distractions. It's not going to get done if you don't have some sort of schedule in place.
Yeah, and you kind of have to stick to it as much as possible. When I was writing with traditional publishing, I did have another job as well. And it did get very difficult to figure out when are you going to carve out time. But I just you have to give up stuff. And so people would be like, oh, did you just see the latest episode of blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, I have not watched television in 6 months. Not because, you know, like, oh, I'm so intellectual, I don't watch television or some BS like that, but more like, well, I had to use that time to write because otherwise it just wasn't going to get done.
Yeah.
So not having kids, I'm sure, helped a lot because then I wasn't beholden to, you know, actually, you know, like, oh, hi, kids, you know,
I'm still alive. I have to feed you.
I have to feed you. I'm not self-cleaning yet. What's going on? Yeah. So that probably helped quite a bit because then it would have been even more. But yeah, you just got to figure out what am I willing to give up? And maybe it's looking at Facebook for half an hour. Maybe it's watching this television show right now instead of binging on it later on. Or
yeah.
Another thing that really helps too is figuring out when you're the most productive word count wise. And there's actually a really good book out there called 2000 to 10,000.
Oh yeah, I've read it.
Yeah. And she talks, Rachel Aaron is the writer, and she talks about doing, you know, just a simple spreadsheet and saying like, okay, you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning and wrote, how many words did you get down? How long did you write and how many words did you get down? Versus 3 in the afternoon when you were waiting in line for outside your kid's school or whatever. And that can really, it's astonishing, like, what a difference. You don't necessarily realize that you're getting so much more done. So I get most of my writing done in the morning. I'm just, like, way faster for whatever reasons. So I scheduled it. I moved my exercise time to the afternoon when I was being less productive and started writing in the morning.
There's a phrase, or maybe not a phrase, like almost a motto. If anyone's ever done Nano, they probably recognize it. But it's basically allowing yourself to be selfish and prioritize your writing. And I don't actually like looking at it that way, but I think that that's the shorthand for allow yourself to get to a place where you have no distractions, where you don't feel guilty for not accepting a dinner invitation every once in a while. Because the work isn't going to get done unless you prioritize it. And sometimes, like you said, it means giving up, you know, watching a TV show. It means not going sailing that day, although I wish that was an issue I faced. I wish that was something I had to, no, I can't, I mustn't, I have to work. But yeah, I like the idea of giving yourself permission. It feels strange because you're not really sure if it's a job or a hobby. And if it's a hobby, it feels like something that you should be able to balance with your other life. But if it's a job, no one expects you to be productive when you're sitting in an office cubicle. Hey, come out with me. Hey, you know, skip work and let's go to the park. Like, no one expects that from you when, you know, you have a 9-to-5. But when you're writing, it doesn't look like that. They think your evenings are free, and maybe they're not. And you have to allow yourself to tell other people and the voice in your head that it is perfectly acceptable that I stay at home in my office or on my couch and write.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that's also, you know, touching on what you said about is it a hobby or a job, like understanding what do you want from it.
Mm-hmm.
Because people be like, what should I do? It's like, well, what do you want? Because it's going to look totally different. There's nothing in the world wrong with just writing for a hobby and, you know, maybe getting a few extra bucks through mm-hmm. your, you know, that's absolutely, there is nothing wrong with that. So if that's what you do, then things are going to be different. You don't have to feel guilty about not sitting down writing every day or whatever. It versus like, well, if you want this to be your full-time job, that's a different path. And like you said, you have to give yourself permission to say, no, I don't have time to go out drinking, or I don't have time to go to this party this week because I'm on deadline or whatever.
It's a strange space to be a working creative, and whatever that looks like for different people. It's even hard to budget time when it is a hobby because no one can procrastinate like an artistic type. Like, nobody can find something else to do that isn't finishing that drawing or scripting something, or like, there's always dishes. I can always do the dishes. I can always rearrange my filing cabinet. I can suddenly I'm so productive at everything that isn't this one thing. Because it's hard. It's a hard thing to do even as a hobby. And you have to determine what your personal level investment is in not just writing, but in how much time you're going to spend editing it, how much marketing are you going to do? Is it maybe a better option to go with a publisher or to do some hybrid publishing because you don't know how much time you can spend formatting stuff, if that's worth it to you?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
you know, let's say you put out a book and it only sells X amount of copies and you only make this much money, at least for that quarter or that month, you realize, oh, wait, all of this time that I spent, I made less than minimum wage. Is this feasible for me? Or is this something where I just like doing it? Yeah, yeah, you're going to, especially at first.
At first, you're going to, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my first year, I lost money. You know, I had to sit there in front of the tax office, you know, when I just painted come out and Wittersen's just come out, and I'd already paid at both of those and Hunter of Demons. You know, I lost money that year, and that was fine.
Yeah.
You know, and I went to GRL that year, so that was written off too. So, I mean, I had a lot of, you know, expenses. And so, yeah, I didn't make anything that year, but that was fine. Because that, just understanding that's part of it. And yeah, adding that into like, well, how am I going to prioritize? Can I prioritize this? It's okay if it takes you longer. Yeah, if you have to prioritize so that you can't do it constantly, you have to put stuff off. That's fine as long as you understand that, yeah, okay, it's going to take some time mm-hmm. to get a career built. But that's fine. It doesn't have to be overnight. This is a marathon. And not a, you know, sprint.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no one size fits all, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. I think I wanted to ask a little bit about, you know, you write series primarily. Did you set out with all of those and know, okay, well, I'm going to write, you know, Wyborn and Griffin, and this is how many books it's going to be? Or did you only plot out, you know, 3 or 6 and then surprise yourself along the way? Like, was it a macro vision, or did you sort of pants it along the way?
The answer is it depends on the series. Mm. So the first Spectre series, part of it was like a challenge to myself. So it's a series of novellas that I wrote to kind of read like a season of television. So I had one overall arc that I was going to tell that each of those would tie into a bit more tightly than they might like in a long drawn out novel series. So it's sort of telling one story, even though each one had its own mini arc within that. So I actually laid that out pretty tightly right from the start. So I knew there was going to be 6 books and what things in the major arc had to happen in each one of them. Everybody always laughs when I say this, but I thought Wittersen's going to be 1 book. Nobody else was going to read it but me.
Oh,
so true story time. I wrote Hated first, and while I was working on it, I had the idea for Wittersen's, and I was like, oh my God, Jordan, really? You're supposed to be getting serious about this whole writing thing. You know, your writing is weird. It doesn't even have a genre. Is it paranormal? Is it historical? You know, the main character's a dork. It's first person. It's got all these things that everyone says don't do. I thought, oh Lord, I can't write this book. And I thought, well, okay, yes, I'm kind of trying to get serious about making writing a real bill-paying career, but I can't just not have any fun. I mean, come on, you know. So I said, well, I'll write one. And I got to the end of it, and I was kind of like, well, all right, I have enough time. I can write one more. It's going to be 2, and that's going to be it. And fortunately, at that time, that was when it started. I was already starting on the second one when that January that I talked about earlier, where it kind of caught on and suddenly it was, people were talking about it, and people I didn't even know were talking about it. And oh my God, you know, so I was actually pretty good positioned. I'd already started the second one. So I was like, well, heck, let's see how this goes. So even though I had some sort of vague ideas of longer term things, I hadn't actually intended on writing them until suddenly I was. It actually, I'm kind of surprised that it hangs together as well as it does as a series, because I was not really planning on that at the beginning.
Yeah, I wondered about that with something with so many books in it. I think most authors at least have an idea of what will happen after, even if they don't plan on writing the rest of the story or the series in this case. You know, I reading through just Wittersen's, as a reader, if you had stopped there, you would have had mass revolt. Everyone loves a lovely standalone, but you can always tell when an author has more story in them. You're just like, I'm going to harass you until you slowly give me what I want.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is I'm finally writing the story that I'd been thinking of kind of from the beginning. Even from the beginning, I was like, oh, I really want to take Griffin back to, you know, Kansas. And it took me to book 8 to actually do that.
The long payoff.
Yeah.
Long payoff.
Wanted to ask you too, because you mentioned before your genre is sort of hard to describe because it's spec, it's like paranormal historical, at least for Wyborn and Griffin, and you write other stuff too, but like looking at your catalog, it is very heavily spec fiction based. Is that the main thing you're drawn to, or do you have a secret longing to write a contemporary meet cute somewhere?
Only if there can be magic or werewolves involved. Yeah, and I do read some contemporary, but I've just always been a spec fic writer at heart, just ever since I was a little kid. I can't imagine writing just a contemporary or just a mystery or just a, I mean, I might someday write just a historical, I don't know, but at least that seems a little bit, that's not just the ordinary day-to-day life we live, so maybe that would be enough. I don't know. But I like mixing it up. I like having a paranormal element, whether that is, urban fantasy or historical fantasy.
Yeah, I'm a huge spec fiction fan, and most of what I read is that. I mean, I like a good contemporary story, but where my heart is definitely spec fiction.
I mean, to be fair, K.J. Charles's Seditious Affair was my favorite book of last year by far, and that's absolutely a
So good.
historical.
It's so, this is embarrassing. Like every single episode just turns into us being embarrassing about K.J. Charles. It's so
Well,
bad.
with good reason. She's
It's
so
so
amazing,
bad.
right? I mean, duh. So, there's most of what I read is spec fic, though. That's like my big her and Rhys Ford series, just because there's a lot of action and things blowing up and stuff. If there's a hail of gunfire and things blowing up, apparently I'm okay with contemporary.
Yeah, there needs to be an element for me. It needs to not just be a contemporary meet cute. I've read perfectly lovely contemporary romances, but I usually need that extra layer of something. And that was what was funny is when I was doing my prelim research on you and I was Googling around and like finding your bio and reading over your blog and doing all of that good stuff. Everything I kept coming up with was if there are two authors who, if you recommend one, someone else recommends the other, it's you and KJ Charles, which makes a
Yep.
lot of sense.
I was so excited when she announced The Magpie Lord because I was like, oh my God, my genre just doubled. It's not just me. Because when I'm sure other people had done this very close to reality, but with a paranormal element and historical stuff before, but I had not run across it. So when Wittershins came out, I was like, I don't know what to call this. Like, it's paranormal, but it's also historical and not like a total fantasy world historical. And what is this? And I was like, oh my God, my genre doubled. There's another crazy person out there writing this too.
My hope is that, I mean, because you and KJ are so popular and so beloved, my hope is that because you guys are sort of the figurehead for this little niche of a like this little Venn diagram of a genre, that more people will come to it because it's my favorite. And there has been some growth, but I'm just waiting for it to explode. I want it to so badly. I just want all of the sort of historical paranormal in the world. Actually, I would love more lesbian historical paranormal. I would sign up for
Yes.
that in a heartbeat.
Yes. Yeah, I would
Daydreams.
love to read more in the genre. I mean, oh my God, bring me more, please. But
I
yeah, I
know.
would love to read some FF.
This
I'm
is,
going to be
yeah.
doing an FF novella later on in the year.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's from the Wyborn Griffin's little short. I don't even have like the plot yet, but it's between Persephone and Miss Parkhurst because their pairing was very popular, and I'm like, well, heck, I'll just write a little novella about them. So
I'm gonna look out for that too.
yeah, I feel like this is a great call to action for us
Yes.
to leave off with. Write more historical paranormal if that's what
Write
we're
more
going.
historical spec, basically. Just
Yeah.
more of
Yes.
it. I'll take every flavor of it. I'll take creepy, I'll take fluffy, I'll take anything. Just give it to me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the conversation. I'm really, really happy that we did this episode, and I think it's going to be really useful for
Yeah.
new authors, especially.
Or people looking to, yeah, to cross over into hybrid publishing.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Hopeless Romantic. As always, if you would like to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter at the HR Podcast. You can find our personal Twitters. I'm at Austin Chanted.
I am at Amanda H. Jean.
And I'm at Jordan L. Hawk.
Thank you so much.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Dario DeFore, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at The HR Podcast, add us on Facebook, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.